how I became a Christadelphian. Those who have read The Ways of Providence by Robert Roberts will be familiar with the conception of the unseen working of the hand of God in human affairs, as exemplified in the lives of many biblical characters. But God has not ceased to work in the lives of his people, and it is one of the most encouraging and exciting experiences to hear the accounts of many brethren and sisters who are convinced that it was a providential act which brought them into contact with the truth. That is why I have called this collection of stories How I Became a Christadelphian. It is not my own story, for like so many more, I was brought up in a Christadelphian home and Sunday school, and being baptized was almost the natural thing to do. It is probably true to say that a very large part of our recruitment comes in this way, but the stories I have to record here are of those who came to know the truth from a non-Christadelphian background, and in some cases almost in spite of themselves. These are the stories which seem more likely to yield examples of the ways of providence. Take the case of Brother Laurie Green, who wrote to me many years ago from an address in New Zealand, and I quote his own description of how he had a second chance by the grace of God, having at first thrown it in the gutter. Here is what he wrote. Some long while before the last war, I would estimate about 1933, I was leaving Leyden Station when on the footpath I was handed a leaflet advertising some Bible lectures by a group of people I'd never heard of. I read it, without interest, then screwed it up and threw it in the gutter. After I got home and had my evening meal, however, an elderly friend of our family called round saying, "Look, I've been handed this leaflet about a Bible lecture tonight. Let's all go and hear it." So we did. It was, as you will have guessed, a Christadelphian lecture, the last of a series, and included an illustrated chart of Daniel's image. We were very impressed, but after reading a number of Christadelphian books, we had no other contact until during the war, when a meeting was started at Leyden, which we then attended and were later baptized. Dear brother, but for God's infinite mercy, I would never have heard of his kingdom and the offer of salvation through his dear son. The invitation, as I said, I threw away. I still go hot and cold when I think of it. I have heard of other similar cases in which leaflets have been rejected or refused, and yet the Lord came back again, as it were, and the call just would not go away and had to be attended to. Brother Bob Rowntree actually retrieved a bundle of Christadelphian literature from the dustbin to get his call. It happened like this. His sister and her husband had come into contact with the Christadelphians after the last war, somewhere down in East Anglia. Bob and his wife were living in Lancashire and had no particular interest in religion at all. Bob was disappointed that his sister had espoused such a cranky religion, for they had always been very close. Now she kept sending him pamphlets and booklets on biblical matters. He couldn't be bothered even to read them, however, and just put them on one side unread. They began to pile up, and then came a time when he had to move house. In all the clearing out that accompanies removal, he came upon this pile of literature about his sister's new religion, and decided to get rid of it, so he tied it all up with a string and put it out for the dustman to take away. But his conscience smote him. Going back indoors, he thought how unkind it was to treat his sister's efforts in such a cavalier manner. So he went back to the dustbin and retrieved them. He decided instead that when he had got the removal over, he would look through the literature, feeling confident that he would be able to convince his sister how wrong it all was. Needless to say, once he got down to really examining the material, he found that he couldn't disprove it and was himself converted. What made him go back to the dustbin and recover those leaflets, which were to change his whole life? Was not the hand of God in this? Bob will say it was. I remember Brother John Stokes relating how he came into the truth by means of a brother whose car in which they were travelling stopped sharply at some traffic lights. He was out on business with a colleague who was a Christadelphian, though he had not known this until he stopped his car very suddenly at the lights, and from the front pocket a leaflet fell out. John, who was the passenger, retrieved it from the floor and found that it was about the state of Israel in relation to Bible prophecy. He asked his colleague if he were interested in this, and of course it started off a discussion, which eventually led to both John and his wife becoming Christadelphians themselves. His friend, by the way, was Brother Alex Riley, who later died in the home and hospital from multiple sclerosis, and will be remembered by some of the older nursing staff there. All credit to him that he had the leaflet in his car, but whose credit was it that it should fall out and so attract the attention of a teachable passenger? And all because he made a bad stop at some traffic lights. Providence consists in the divine regulation of natural circumstances, wrote Brother Roberts in the book referred to above. And it is this kind of experience which has convinced so many brethren and sisters that their calling was not by chance, and that the natural circumstances of their lives have indeed been overruled by divine providence to lead them to a knowledge of his word. The late Brother Edwin Yearsley brought many people into the truth, yet I never once heard him speak on the platform. It is an interesting fact that some of our most successful preachers have not been speakers in the accepted sense at all, and many have been sisters. Edwin had a fund of interesting stories about people he had influenced, one of which related to a man he has whistled into the truth. It appears that this gentleman had attended a special lecture many years ago, but didn't come again as our brother had hoped, and he'd almost forgotten him when one day he was cleaning his windows at the front of his house when he saw the young man go past on his cycle and recognised him. He couldn't think of any way to catch his attention other than to give a loud whistle, which arrested the cyclist in his tracks and brought him back to see what he wanted. Edwin then told him that he'd seen him at the meeting some time before and was sorry he had not come again. From this developed a conversation which resulted in the young man coming round to see him, and eventually he was baptised. So Brother Edwin was able to say that he had whistled him into the truth. Sister Marjorie White, now at the Bury St. Edmunds meeting, sent me her story as follows. She had a gift shop and was approached by a Christadelphian with a request to put up a notice for the Bible exhibition which was being staged locally. At the same time, she was naturally given a personal invitation to attend herself. This she did, but only on the final night. The result was that both she, her husband, her son, her aunt, her sister, and her neighbour were all eventually baptised. Just previously, however, she had been involved in some meetings at the Congregational Church in which she and her husband belonged, which had prepared her for the challenge of the truth. This is her own account of what took place. We were continually asking the minister to arrange a Bible class, as we felt that it was very much needed, but he wasn't interested. However, a few weeks later, he phoned me to ask if I would become a group leader for the future amalgamation of the churches. At first I protested, explaining to him that I didn't know my Bible sufficiently to enable me to answer the questions which I knew would eventually have to be put before the interdenominational meeting. He assured me that I would manage and gave me numerous questions relating to the Bible which I had to discuss with my group at weekly meetings over the following 3 months. This was a difficult time for me, as my husband was very ill, and I was also trying to cope with our business. But with the cooperation of my group, I was able to return to the group leaders' meeting with a long list of answers. To my concern, I was told that this list had to be reduced to only 7 to be put to the interdenominational meeting, and I had also to prepare a personal question of my own. Along came the evening when we had to face about 200 members of the clergy and other congregations. When my turn came, I think my heart thumped louder than my voice sounded. However, I gave my 7 answers, and then came my own personal question. So I asked, "How many of you in this room own a Bible?" There was no reply. Possibly 50%, I thought. "Well then, I wonder how many of you own a Bible but seldom read it?" Still no reply. My heart began to thump louder. Possibly 25%. "I wonder how many of you read it on Sundays only?" Deathly silence. You could have heard a pin drop. Maybe 10%? Finally, I asked, "How many read it every day?" I don't suppose 5% of the people in that room answered. Therefore, my own answer to them was, "Get back to Bible reading." "Can you wonder," concludes Sister White, "that I became a Christadelphian? Is it not strange that all this should have happened just before the Bible exhibition came to her town and she was approached about placing a bill in her window?" Brother Jeff Hammett, known to many for his Bible mission activities, sent me this account of how his own father became a Christadelphian. "In the latter part of 1913, my father, who was a watch and clockmaker and jeweller, opened a small business near Newport, now in Gwent. He rented premises which were part of a dwelling house, and as home was 25 miles away, he also lodged in, but went home most weekends. He rented the premises from a couple who were Christadelphians and members of the Newport meeting. Neither could have been considered very well educated, but the sister at least must have been very conscious of her mission to preach the word. During the day when the business was open, the sister used to bring in my father's meals, and as she would do so, would say, on one occasion, 'There's a terrible time coming.' On the next occasion, 'There's a wonderful time coming.' These words were repeated over and over again, and my father's first and natural reaction was to think the woman must be mad. On inquiring what it was she was trying to tell him, the sister could only refer him to a book he ought to read, which would explain God's purpose. My father didn't hold any particular religious convictions, and was not a chapel or churchgoer. He had been brought up in the Unitarian Church, but was not himself religious. There came one weekend when, for some reason or other, my father couldn't go home, as was his usual wont, and had to stay over the Sunday. Came the Sunday evening, and the sister and her husband prepared to go to the evening lecture. My father was sitting in the living room, waiting for the local to open. Whether he'd been invited to go with them to the lecture, I can't say, but as they were leaving, the sister said, 'That book I've been telling you about is in the bookcase behind you.' My father thought, 'I'd better look at it, I suppose.' So, having a little while to wait, turned round and took the book down. It was, of course, Christendom Astray. He opened it and started reading. There was no visit to the local that night, and my father was not content until he had read through to the end. When one thinks of my father's limited education, leaving school at 12, and many others like him of that generation, it speaks volumes for his grasp of understanding to become so fascinated with Robert Roberts's not-easy-to-read exposition of Bible truth. He was soon convinced of the need to read and understand the Bible and commenced attending lectures, but mostly because of his weekends at home, going to a brother's house for conversation. By April 19, my father was interviewed and baptised. Brother Hugh Hood, recording brother in Glasgow for 30 years, tells of his own conversion many years ago as follows. During tea breaks in a works canteen, a fellow worker was telling of a visit he'd had from his local Roman Catholic priest. I turned to another colleague, I was then only mildly interested in religion, and ventured to suggest that we are indebted to the Roman Church for preserving the sacred writings for us. This point was resolutely opposed by my workmate, who invited me to sit by him at a table on their own and talk about Bible matters. He was a Christadelphian and later handed me some of the easier items of the truth literature. This continued for about 2 years. Then came lectures and eventually, in 1928, my baptism followed by my wife. Then son and daughter, now three of their children, share the same hope. My wife's brother also obeyed the truth, then his wife, then his son. And so it goes on. Brotherhood also gives other examples, including a lady who was looking through the Glasgow telephone directory and saw an entry for the Christadelphians with his number attached. She had come from Australia, where she had noticed an advertisement for one of Brother Alan Haywood's books, but had done nothing about it at the time. So she now rang up the Glasgow number, and Brother Hugh arranged to take the book round to her address. The result was that not only she, but her sister and her husband all accepted the gospel invitation. So the advertisement in Australia bore fruit in Glasgow, and all, humanly speaking, through an entry in a telephone directory. From Brother Will Webster of Clevedon, I received an interesting catalogue of baptisms which resulted from an accident to a brother in America. His name was Brother Bigger, and he and his wife had been baptised in Glasgow in the 1880s. Very soon after, writes Brother Will, they emigrated to the USA, living in Worcester, Massachusetts. About 1906, Brother Bigger was drowned in an accident on the river, and his widow was advised to return to England to recover from the shock. She stayed with my maternal grandmother, then living at Plaistow in London. My grandmother was a Congregationalist and tried to persuade her sister to go with her to her church, but Sister Bigger would have none of it, and instead she was able to get her to go to the Ilford Ecclesia with her three daughters, where they were all baptised in 1909-10. My grandfather was also baptised in 1911, and later my mother followed, and I myself was baptised in 1921. Altogether, at least 20 baptisms have resulted from that tragedy in the USA, which caused the stricken Sister Bigger to come back to her homeland. Brother Will also has an interesting story about Brother E.A. Parsons, the author of the popular hymn 177, Father of Lights, who moved to Ilford, London, around the turn of the century. One day he contacted a local builder on business, and when the conversation turned to religion, it turned out that he was an agnostic, particularly over the state of the dead. Brother Parsons produced from the pocket of his frock coat a Bible, and so impressed the builder that he agreed to attend the lectures at North London, with the result that he was baptised in 1902. But that was only the beginning of the story, for Brother Bishop, the builder, put the truth to one of his customers who accepted it and was baptised. He was an Armenian by birth, with a splendid knowledge of all Eastern languages, employed as an interpreter in London. His wife, son and daughter were also baptised, and eventually, through their influence, at least 16 baptisms resulted, and all from a business conversation between a brother and a builder. Although it is not concerned with the subject of this chapter, I will add here a very pleasant anecdote that Brother Will included in his letter concerning the late Brother Frank Janaway, who was never one to be lost for words. This is the story as he tells it. During the First World War, there were several brethren in prison in Wormwood Scrubs, and Brother Frank Janaway obtained permission to hold a weekly Bible class on condition that nothing else was brought into the conversations. A warder was also present to ensure that this condition was observed. When Field Marshal Allenby captured Jerusalem in 1917, Brother Frank was anxious to let the brethren know about it. So, on this particular visit, before commencing the class, he turned to the warder, saying, "Is it in order for me to tell these men that Jerusalem has been captured by the British?" The warder replied, "Certainly not." But of course the great news had already been conveyed, and the hearts of the brethren cheered. "This story," writes Brother Will, "was told to me by one of the brethren actually there, Brother F.C. Wood, who, at the time of writing, is still alive." Brother John Collier of Grimsby, after mentioning that his father had in mind a similar collection of How I Became a Christadelphian stories to be called Romances of the Truth, goes on to say, "There is certainly a tremendous fund of divine coincidences and strange ways in which our Heavenly Father has worked. One of the most amazing that I have heard, but cannot give much detail, is that of one of Kaiser Wilhelm's guard, who deserted and eventually reached London, where he met a sister and learned the truth. He spent his last days at Scarborough, where he was recording brother of a tiny meeting there in the 1930s. Here is a story of a chain of events that I personally was involved in. In 1928, a very young brother was a bread delivery boy. He called at a house in the country with bread when two warplanes flew over very low. The lady asked, 'Is there going to be another war?' The boy replied that there would be before Jesus came back again to reign in peace. A voice from inside said, 'Come in and tell us about it.' Eventual result was 4 baptisms. But the man of the house worked at a yard where he was passing on the news that the boy kept telling him to a lorry driver. Before long, the lorry driver, his wife and 3 friends were baptized. One day the driver had a young man with him in the lorry who was whistling a hymn tune, Rimington. The driver asked him if he believed the words of that hymn, 'Jesus shall reign where'er the sun.' Thus the truth was easily introduced, with the eventual result of 4 baptisms. That young man became a bricklayer and was working one day at a furnace when the stoker said, 'I've been looking for the truth all my life.' He soon found it and was baptized. Meanwhile, a son of the bricklayer working in an office was noticed by one of the girls as being different, and eventually she boldly asked him what it was that made him so different. He brought her to a meeting, and eventually she also became different and was baptized. Another story of a chain that I have been and am still involved in," goes on Brother Collier. "A young brother felt that his ecclesia was not doing enough publicity, and asked if he might do some personally at his own expense. So he put a tiny ad in the paper saying, 'Bible reading groups being formed, ring this number.' He received 4 replies, but had to leave the town before he could go to see them. Giving the addresses to another brother, that brother was received at one of the houses with the words, 'We were just waiting for you, come in.' He found a family in dire trouble who were trying to find consolation in the Bible but didn't know where to look. Man and wife were baptized, They couldn't keep their big mouths shut. They had to share the good news they'd learned with relatives and workmates. Thus began a chain of contacts, and eventually baptisms, which have now reached over 12 in number. I know a sister who had been born into a Christadelphian family and had attended Sunday school, but went nursing during the war, and gradually lost contact with her family and with the truth. Late in life, she was bereaved of her husband, and bethought herself of her beginnings and of the Christadelphians. At this time, a large advertisement in the Daily Express caught her attention, offering Christadelphian literature. She wrote and felt she was in touch again. Then she was very ill, finally convalescing at a seaside resort where she went into a small cafe one Sunday. She asked the waitress if she could recommend a church where the singing was good, to be told that if she, the waitress, went anywhere, it was to the Christadelphians. The result was that the invalid arrived at the Sunday evening meeting and made herself known. She quickly picked up the threads that she had dropped so long before and was baptized and became a very valuable member of a small and ailing meeting, being a real mother in Israel to the young members. Sister Grace Shire writes from the Christadelphian home at Western Vale, Weston-super-Mare, to tell how she came into the truth by what she calls a little detective work, by tracking her employer, who was a Christadelphian. It happened like this. After attending the village school where she lived with her parents, Grace left at age 13 and attended confirmation classes at her local church. But when she began to ask questions about the doctrine of the Trinity, she was fobbed off by the pastor and so decided it was not for her. As she was fond of children, her school teacher suggested that she should go to work in a boarding school as an assistant to the matron. This took her to Sherborne, Dorset, where she got on very well with the matron, who was an exceptionally nice person. She didn't know at the time that she was a Christadelphian, but she did notice that each time the lady hairdresser came to do the girl's hair, there was a conversation about the Bible between her and the matron, to which the young new girl listened with growing interest as she dried the hair of her charges. She had promised her mother that she would attend some kind of religious service each Sunday, and accordingly, she tried various churches in the town, but didn't find any of them satisfying to her needs. So, one Sunday, she made up her mind to follow her matron from a distance, knowing that she always went to some place of worship, but not knowing that it was a Christadelphian meeting. She saw her enter a building and go upstairs, so Grace followed with some trepidation and took a seat on the back row. Her boss, however, saw her, and returned from her seat at the front to sit with the young girl from the school. By a coincidence, the lecture was on the very subject which had been troubling her, the Trinity, so her interest was immediately kindled. When Sister Farrant, for that was the matron's name, asked what had brought her to the meeting, Grace replied that it was the way she lived and the kindness she had showed to her young assistant. What a testimony that was, and a lesson to us all. So, after this, Grace attended regularly, and a few months later she applied for baptism. But the changed attitudes of then and now are reflected in her letter, from which I quote, "Brother Ward, the recording brother, was insistent that I must get permission from one of my parents before allowing me to be baptized, as I was not 21. So I went home 2 weeks in succession, cycling 5 miles each way, but my mother said she would never give her permission. On the third week, I waited to see my father, and he gave me permission. So I was baptized on November 1st, 1919, which means I've been a Christadelphian for 64 years, on the 1st of November 1983, God willing. Years afterwards, when my mother had passed away, I asked my father for his permission to entertain, and he said, "I'm glad you kept to that religion, for you have some very nice friends." A nice unsolicited testimonial, by the way, which goes to show that people do notice. I received from Brother Harry Whittaker several examples of the way in which God has brought people to a knowledge of the truth, and the first concerns Brother Fred Northrop, who in the spring of 1918, he writes, was a typical Yorkshireman and found himself a prisoner of war in a German camp. What a nightmare the past 12 months had been. He'd been getting on fine in the army. Promotion had been rapid. To be colour sergeant major at the age of 21 wasn't bad going. Then in 1917, in a terrific attack near St. Omer, he had stopped one. A wretched, agonising crawl for 1.5 miles took him to safety. Now for Blighty. But alas, no such luck. The Boulogne Hospital had him back in the front line in December, just when everything was boiling up in that sector for the worst possible. Month after month it went on, one heavy attack after another. In March he was taken prisoner. A fortnight later he'd escaped and found his way back to his regiment. In May he was once again a prisoner of war, this time till the armistice. Like every other British soldier in that Westphalian camp, he now lived only for the next mail from home. Some parcels came from a young lady named Emmy Dutton, who was later to become his wife. Often included in these parcels were some Christadelphian leaflets, which he read time after time. "This religion makes sense," said Fred to himself. "When I'm back in Blighty, I'll go into it seriously." This he did. With the end of the war came freedom, back to England, baptism and marriage. Some years went by. Fred was now a speaking brother, useful to a number of neighbouring ecclesias. One day there came a phone call from a Harris recording brother in the next town, no speaker for the ensuing Sunday. The brother expected had had teeth extracted and was ordered a comba. Could Fred come? Yes, gladly. It happened to be the town where Fred had been born. Although when quite a baby and left an orphan, he had been adopted by another family and brought up in another town. Fred's hostess that Sunday was an aged sister who died only a few months later. At tea, he mentioned his wish to be at the meeting in good time to meet a cousin, Annie Hurst by name, who was coming to hear his talk. "Why," said his hostess, "I know all the Hursts in this town and their relations. If you're related to them, how do you come to be called Northrop?" Fred recounted the story of his adoption and change of name. Question and answer now followed in rapid succession, and with intensifying excitement on the old lady's part, until eventually, "Yes, I'm sure of it. I knew you when you were a baby. And what's more, your mother and grandmother were Christadelphians." Almost beside herself with excitement, Sister Aykroyd hobbled upstairs as fast as her rheumaticky legs would allow, and returned with a massive Victorian family album. "There, look through that." Fred hadn't searched for long before he came across a photograph of his mother, which was identical with one that he had inherited, along with his mother's Bible. Many a time when he had read from this Bible, he had remarked that some of the notes scribbled on the fly leaf could well have been written by a Christadelphian, and now he knew that they were. Imagine, then, the awe and gladness with which he learned this utterly unexpected and thrilling news, that his own real mother had been in the faith before him. That evening he spoke like a man inspired. He wasn't just a lecturer, he was a preacher, and with good reason, for had he not just seen the evidence of God's hand at work in his very own life? Soon after this, Fred was enabled to refer to the library of a brother who had some bound copies of the Christadelphian magazine going back 50 years, and there he discovered the wonderful record of his mother's and grandmother's baptisms 10 years before his birth. Yet, but for that strange mischance, which for once threw out the speaking arrangements at that Christadelphian ecclesia, Mother Fred Northrop might have lived and died in ignorance of the information which he now so highly treasures, and which makes his hope in the resurrection of the dead yet more firm and keen. And moreover, nothing is more certain than that the young mother, dying prematurely and leaving an orphan baby, would in those last moments of life have prayed God to take care of her helpless little boy and bring him in due course into the way of salvation. That prayer was heard, and the angel sent forth the minister to this heir of salvation did his work well. So, through all the worst horrors of war and the prisoner of war camp, Fred Northrop, the worldling, was guarded and guided to his better destiny as a soldier of Christ. Another story of Brother Harry's concerns a fictitious Brother Brown, the names having been disguised for obvious reasons. Brother Brown was an energetic sort of man, endowed with a particularly robust and healthy constitution. But on this particular morning he woke early with a violent pain in his chest. Whatever was the matter with him? What could be the cause of it? Wasn't it a pain like this that began Brother Jones's illness? And he died only a few months later, before his time, too. Fine fellow, Brother Jones. What a pity that when he died he hadn't the consolation of seeing his daughter Mary in the faith that he and his wife had espoused so many years earlier. Besides, she was such a nice girl, brought up in the Sunday school, with every opportunity and encouragement to embrace the faith of her parents. But no, as in the case of so many young folks growing up in Christadelphian homes, familiarity had bred contempt, and she had drifted away from those early wholesome influences into the paganism characteristic of so many in this generation. Let's see, where is Mary nowadays? She's married, isn't she, and living somewhere in another part of the town. The day of the coming of the Lord draws near, and that girl has turned her back on the truth of Christ. Does she realize what a fool she has been? And what, Brother Brown asked himself, what have I done to warn Mary of her folly? I surely ought to make it in my way to see her and talk to her plainly, and to appeal to her to consider her own position. What's more, I will. This is something too important to be neglected. By this time, that acute pain was gone. Whatever it was, it had done its work. And Brother Brown, still musing on Mary's foolish waywardness, got up and went off to his business. He could scarcely restrain his excitement when, a few minutes later, there walked into his store the very girl he'd been thinking about. She made her purchases and chatted a while. Brother Brown, a fervent believer in the ways of God's providence, saw his opportunity and took it with both hands. He reminded Mary of her early training in the truth, and appealed to her to consider again the life in Christ and all that it could mean for her. Mary was impressed. How could she fail to be impressed? And it was agreed that she and her husband should spend the following evening at the home of Brother Brown. It turned out that Mary's husband was a native of India, an intelligent young fellow with film star features, who had been sent to England for special training in electrical engineering. Mary had met him, fallen in love, and married him, differences of race and religion being no deterrent, and their married life was, by this world's standards, an extremely happy one. The visit to Brother Brown's home was made as promised, conversation ranged by his design, over all kinds of topics, gardening, the weather, holidays, music. anything but the one theme Bob Brown was most anxious to bring up. Time passed pleasantly and pointlessly. When goodbyes were being said, "Thank you, Mr. Brown, for a very nice evening, but I can't help feeling a trifle disappointed. I thought you were going to talk to us about the truth. My husband would be very interested to hear you on it, and you haven't said a word about that." "Why, if that's what you wish," he replied, "you can come to my home as often as you like and whenever you like." In this way they began a series of fascinating, interesting explorations into the principles of the faith, Mary rapidly reassimilating what she had nearly forgotten, and her husband's alert, receptive, religious mind readily keeping in step with her. In the midst of this came intimation that he must return to India as soon as possible. This meant that there must be readiness to embark at 12 hours' notice, for this was during the 39-45 war, when the few sailing berths available were by allocation and not by choice. The unpleasant situation was faced resolutely. This might be their last contact with the truth for many years. So there was immediate application for baptism. Every help was given by the local ecclesia, and within 3 days, this unusual couple made confession of their newfound faith in Christ, were baptized, received the right hand of fellowship, and broke bread with their brethren and sisters for the first and perhaps the last time in their lives. It was a moving experience for all concerned. The expected summons came to join the ship. The young couple spent their last night in Britain at the home of a brother in Glasgow, and the next morning their ship sailed from the Clyde. Arrival at the home in Calcutta provided an immediate and drastic test of the faith of these newborn children of God. It was a dreadful experience. The father, a wealthy man and a zealot in his religion, stormed and raved at his son for what he deemed to be apostasy and for marriage to a Christian. Unless there was immediate recantation, the son would be disowned and disinherited. The young couple were not even given house room, but were relegated to an old shed at the end of the garden, and there allowed from the house kitchen only the most meagre subsistence possible. The outlook seemed to be as black as could be. Little wonder that under the strain, faith began to crack. But help came in an unexpected disguise. The young man's stepmother showed not only a marked sympathy, but also a genuine interest in this religion of her stepson. To his surprise, she talked with some knowledge and understanding of the truth. "Stick to your faith," she counseled, "for I'm sure it is right." Such an unexpected reinforcement to the flagging courage of these two bewildered, tortured souls was immediately explained when the stepmother produced a well-read copy of Christendom Astray. "Wherever did you get this?" they cried in amazement. "From a friend," was the reply. Then began a frenzied, fascinating investigation to find the original donor of the familiar little book. The trail led halfway across India, but eventually came back to Calcutta, to the home of two middle-aged Christadelphians living only a stone's throw from their own home. Here was fellowship, here was strength. The sorely tested couple thanked God and took courage. The great test of faith was now ended, and without dishonour. It is pleasant to record that the stay in India proved to be of only short duration. Quite soon, opportunity arose for a return to England, another in a long chain of happy chances, and of course, it was seized with both hands. Before long, they were both back in the bosom of an ecclesia where there is neither Jew nor Greek, bond nor free, male nor female, but all are one in him. And that mysterious pain in the chest is mysterious no longer. From Sister Winifred East in Cheshire came an interesting account of how her father, Brother Arthur East, became a Christadelphian and how, in her own words, it seemed our Lord guided his steps from an early age. Born in Kettering in the county of Northamptonshire, the seventh child in a family of 15, Arthur was a bright, intelligent lad at school, and his parents' hopes were that he would, along with three of his brothers, follow his uncle's example and enter the Wesleyan ministry. But Arthur had no such inclination. Religion was not for him. Parsons were dismissed as sky pilots and holy joes. His parents were very disappointed, so the lad decided that he'd best get away from home. He was just 15 when, without any money, he walked the 14 miles to Northampton and, professing to be 17, enlisted in the Royal Navy. For 5 years he served diligently as a Royal Marine and became a first-class gunner. The sea was his delight, and these years, tough as they were, provided excellent training. His first ship was still under sail, and later he saw the first iron battleships powered by steam. He saw the first aeroplane and actually heard the first telegraph message reach the Mediterranean Sea. He was dutiful in all the requirements of Navy life and had to attend church services, but still maintained that religion was not for him. One day, however, his ship HMS Formidable docked in Portsmouth Dockyard, but Arthur had nowhere particular to go, so his mate invited him to accompany him to the home of a Mr. Guy, with whom he had some business to transact. Arthur agreed and received a warm welcome. Now, at this time it happened that Mr. Guy's sister, Emma, was on a visit to her brother, and they were the son and daughter of a Christadelphian family living in Bristol. It was a lovely evening, so a walk was suggested. Arthur found himself attracted to pretty Emma, in spite of his friend's warning that she had some strange religion. Indeed, this rather intrigued him, and he asked Emma about her beliefs. She was very shy, so contented herself to asking him to attend Christadelphian meeting in Portsmouth the following Sunday. He went, and the lecture title was "The City Which Has Foundations," the speaker being a Brother Jackson. He was so impressed with this talk that he kept the notes which he took of it in his wallet for the rest of his life. The truth made a great impact on Arthur, and he was baptised in Portsmouth in the year 1910. It was 4 years before he could get out of the Navy, which had previously been his whole life, and then only with the aid of the Brethren and Sisters of the Portsmouth Ecclesia, who bought him out for the princely sum of £12, in 1914, just before the outbreak of the Great War. Religion was for him, after all, and it became his whole life for the next 60 years, first in Coventry, then Market Drayton, and finally in Crewe, where he served the truth faithfully for the rest of his life, and lived to see his 6 children and his grandchildren all accept the faith. Brother Ernest Pearson of Sheffield has a sad story to tell of how a Bernardo boy found the truth, but it has a happy ending. Let him tell it in his own words. "I was born," he writes, "in London in 1912, youngest of 3 boys, father a saddlemaker, mother the granddaughter of William Mulready, R.A. War was declared in 1914, and my father was sent in the army to Egypt. German airships dropped bombs over London, and one hit our house. Mother was injured and lost both her speech and memory. I became an urchin, wandering around the streets, backyards, dustbins, gutters, looking for waste food, apple cores, bones to suck, orange peel, raw potatoes, in fact anything eatable, and sleeping rough, begging for money. I was eventually picked up and placed in the Dr. Bernardo's home. In 1923, I was sent to a ranch farm in Ontario, Canada, where I became a cowboy. At night, I burnt the midnight oil in developing my inherited talent as an artist, and read Bible stories, which I loved. I attended village chapels and churches on my own, joining in the activities and nursing a desire to become a missionary. After 10 years, in 1933, after working for my keep and very little else, I worked my way back to England on the cattle boat to try to find my relatives. I heard of a distant relation in Sheffield, and worked on the board for him, spending every weekend going to different churches of all religions, searching for the truth. I attended Church of England, Roman Catholic, Salvation Army, Plymouth Brethren, Quakers, many others, and even taught in a Methodist Sunday school, but still couldn't find the answer to the problem of heaven and hell, and what became of people at death. Then one week I was looking down the church notices in the local paper, and saw an advert for the Christadelphians. As this was one which I had never been to, I decided to go. And there I found the pearl of great price for which I'd been searching. I'd already registered as a conscientious objector when I joined the Peace Pledge Union before being baptised as a Christadelphian. But I had to serve terms of imprisonment, including 6 months in a military prison at Northallerton and Barlini Prison in Glasgow, before getting my release after 18 months. But it has all been worth it to find the truth, and now I am enjoying the happiest days of my life in the Lord. Not surprisingly, many of the stories received are on similar lines, and it's not possible to include them all, although they're all equally interesting. They tell of ways in which the truth has been introduced either by chance acquaintances or through people working together and getting into conversation about the Bible, sometimes quite casually. One brother I knew became a Christadelphian simply as a result of a brother working in the same car factory who, during a break, just asked him in conversation if he believed in a God. It set him thinking, and he realised that he didn't really know whether he did or not. So he went home and started to question himself on the matter. This led to him discussing it again with the fellow at work, and eventually he attended meetings and was baptised, along with his wife. All those who have written on these lines are convinced that their chance acquaintances were overruled by the providence of God, who brought them by apparently natural circumstances into contact with believers who were able to introduce them to the Word of Life. I've selected an account from Sister Susan Marrick of Texas, USA, as representative of this kind of conversion, though it could be multiplied many times. Susan writes as follows. For as far back as I can remember, I'd always wanted to understand the Bible. I would listen to preachers and try to make sense of what they were saying by comparing it with what the Bible said. You can imagine how confused that left me. I would watch movies about the Bible and then read the account in the scriptures, always noting a difference in what I saw and what I read. This went on for years until I had gone through several religions looking for the right one. I tried on several hats, Baptist, Methodist, Church of Christ, but still I had questions and uncertainties. This went on until 1970, when I was 24. I had been offered a job with a company which I turned down. They were persistent and a month later offered me another job with them. All the while, a sister had also been offered a job with this company in another division. She was hesitant about taking this job because it meant she would have to drive a long way. She talked it over with her husband, who was a brother, and they decided she should go ahead and take it. In the meantime, I also agreed to take the job offered by the same company, and the stage was set. The first time I ever saw this sister, she was wearing a Star of David, so I naturally assumed she was Jewish. As she and I worked in different departments, we never spoke nor had any dealings with each other. I saw her occasionally at the coffee machine and when leaving work, but I didn't know her, anything about her. I didn't even know her name. So I did take my Bible to work. It was lying on my desk when a man I knew noticed it. He and I talked a lot about English history and felt quite free to say anything to each other. He saw my Bible and started going about making fun of what it said and saying that it was full of a bunch of fairy tales, etc. I will never forget what went through my mind. You're wrong. That is not true. But how do I prove you wrong? He walked off, leaving me with my mouth hanging open. Suddenly, overwhelmingly, I was frantic. An unbelievably desperate feeling came over me. I wish I could find the words to tell you how utterly terrified I was. I got up from my desk and literally ran up the stairs to the sister who wore the Star of David. Remember now, I didn't know her from the Man in the Moon. So it had to be the mighty Lord God who directed me to her at that moment. I went up to her desk and started asking her questions about the Bible. After a few minutes, I suggested she bring her Bible the next day and talk about it together at lunch. Now I know how utterly rare it is for anyone to even listen to what you want to tell them about God's Word, much less suggest themselves that you discuss it at length. We met every day at lunch, and I was amazed at her ability at not only making sense out of the scriptures, but her ease at finding the scriptures to prove everything she said. About a week later, she suggested I come to dinner at her house and meet with her husband. I found out later that she felt like she could take me no further, and it should be turned over to her husband. I went to their house, and after several classes that lasted hours and hours, I jumped up one night and said, "Eureka, I have found it." About 3 or 4 weeks later, on November 30, 1970, I put on the saving name of our beloved King, the Lord Jesus Christ. That was nearly 13 years ago, and today that same sister and I are the best of friends, and she is my true partner and fellow helper. How did it come about that both girls took jobs at the same place, apparently against their first inclination? They will say that it was the overruling providence of God who planned that they should meet in this way, and who can deny it? The colleague who made fun of her when she took her Bible to work was instrumental in driving her in desperation to the one person who was able to satisfy her desire for knowledge. Was this overruled? Who can tell? The Lord can use the most unlikely people and the most unexpected circumstances for his purposes. Like many more correspondents, Susan Marrick is now delighted to be a Christadelphian, rejoicing in God's grace, and convinced that not only in her coming to a knowledge of the truth, but in her private life too, as her letter went on to show, the hand of the Lord has been working in her experiences.